18 hours since assault. Olfactory sensors translated the stench of death into a series of quantifiable molecular components, while audio interceptors turned the snap of Volkite blasters and thrum of radbeamers into wavelength data. To Archmagos Inar Satariel, these added to the beauty of battle, rather than detracted from it, just as the annotation for an orchestral symphony contained all the potential for drama that was then expended during a performance. For the insertion into the heart of the Lionsgate spaceport, he had built himself a warform smaller than the cybernetic monstrosities he had favoured of late. It would be shameful to be denied entry to the control halls because the doorways were not large enough for such a body. Instead, he had focused on anti-personnel weaponry and maximum shield efficiency, as well as the mobility afforded by a hexamal limb layout. Even so, his bulk was twice that of a legionary, though composite materials meant he was no heavier than a normal man. Of these augmentations, the shield boosters were proving the most valuable, deflecting las blasts and autogun rounds by the score every minute as he pressed forward along the arterial passage to the main dockwork controls. Speed was vital. The Iron Warrior, Kroger, had devised a simple plan, and a greater part of it relied upon the systems of the defenders being blind to the true nature of the attack being launched. Should the Archmagos and the ally he was due to meet suffer undue delays, the entire endeavour was at risk. With this in mind, Satariel ploughed into enemy fire with little concern, knowing that the clave of battle servitors that followed would cut down anything that evaded the attention of his Maxim bolters and graviton imploder. Via Neuspheric Pulse, he could also feel the converging approach of his allies in the Iron Warriors. Arriving at an angle of 72 degrees to his own attack, the 4th Legion Assault Force was equally small but specialised. Their combined firepower would swiftly overwhelm any defenders still alive to hold the central command hall. The Archmagos swept through the outer chambers without pause, slave routines directing the fire of his weapons, while his conscious mind applied itself to the matter of the armoured portal sealing the inner sanctum. It was substantial, reinforced with thick bars and heavy-gauge locking wheels. Sparks emanating from the control panel at its side betrayed a desperate ploy by the defenders. The electrical locks had been blown from the inside, impossible to override. They were sealed inside, but it was an effective barrier to Satariel's entry. The continued buzz of overloaded circuits highlighted that the measure had been taken perhaps only a minute earlier, in response to the rapidity of his advance. Melter burners seemed the best option, but there were none in his vanguard. His graviton imploder would eventually twist the door locks into scrap metal, but that would be costly in terms of time and energy output, during which his part in Warsmith Kroger's plan would be unfulfilled, risking the success of the entire enterprise. Though he had every confidence in his own abilities, Satariel considered that it was somewhat foolhardy of Kroger to place so much necessity into a single operation, especially one carried out by a relatively small military force. Whatever the merits of the plan, if the new Mechanicum was to thrive, the overthrow of the false Omnissiah was essential, and Satariel was determined to play whatever part he could in that revolution. The future would be written by visionaries such as himself. As he flashed active surveyor beams across the armoured door to assess its internal structural qualities, Satariel picked up an energy surge close at hand. Two pinpricks of white light resolved into bright patches around the central lock gears. The energy build-up continued until sparks erupted from the near side of the door, moments before the wash of high-intensity radiation burst through the two neat holes. Something powerful slammed against the portal from inside the command terminal chamber, rupturing the remains of the lock's gears. Molten droplets and slivers of metal showered outwards as the door cracked in half, the shriek of tortured metal filling the antechamber as it twisted on its immense hinges. A figure the size of a Legion dreadnought loomed through the smoke of vaporized metal and ceramite, the telltale gleam of two melter cutters where eyes should have been.
"You are late, Archmagos,"
the creature's voice warbled with artificial modulation. But there was also a strange after-effect that did not register with Satariel's senses. the demon voice of the creature's cohabitant.
Fok Saram, I am grateful for your intervention, said the Archmagos. It is a privilege to finally be in your physical vicinity. It is an honor to find alliance with the one who will usher in a new age for the Mechanicum and legions alike.
Fok Saram looked like a legionary in the same way that a battleship might look like an orbital shuttle, if one mistook size for perspective. Everything about it was larger in scale, bloated with the power of the demonic, coupled with the technophagic enhancements it had been given by noted members of the new Mechanicum. It was impossible to tell where ancient battleplate ended and iron-hard skin began, but the gunmetal of its old armour gave way to patches of dark flesh in places, while horns and spines, both of bone and metal, protruded from breaks in the glistening carapace that had once been the Space Marine's power plant backpack. Its form was not static, but an ever-shifting mass, more than simple mutation. The melter cutters, or the analogue the demon-machine hybrid had created, receded into the face, and something approximating human features returned. A flat face with a bulbous nose. The eyes still gleamed with circuitry, devoid of any human feeling.
Are you ready for the transference?
Fok Saram asked, turning away. Bone gears whirred and pistons shuddered with each step it took into the chamber, heading for a hexagonal console bank at the centre. A clawed hand, as large as a service hoist, lifted towards the cogitators.
There is still a connection here we can exploit. You understand what will be required of you? I will divide and conquer, said the hulking creature,
a sketch of a smile twisting its assumed face.
I will obliterate all opposition.
Obliterate? Yes, that is certainly the word. All trace of the previous Incarna Machina will be replaced by your anathemics.
Blood is required, I was told.
Fok Saram turned its arm as though offering a wrist. Metal plates peeled back like the petals of a mechanical flower, exposing blood vessels ribbed with cabling. Thin pipelines carrying other fluids ran alongside, pulsing with red and green and blots of purple. At an urge from the Archmagos, a servitor advanced, a length of sanguinaxial cable coiled in its hands. One end was tipped by a standard Imperial 5-pin interface, the other fitted to a device that looked like the unholy offspring of an intravenous cannula and an ornamental dagger. Satariel snaked out a mechadendrite from beneath his battle form, gently lifting the jagged end of the sanguinaxial cable, while the servitor connected the other to the main console.
You need to appease me first, said the hybrid machine,
drawing the arm away from Satariel's approach.
This is the power of chaos. There are forms and rituals to be observed.
I understand, said the Archmagos,
though in truth his comprehension was limited. There had been nothing like Fok Saram before, and Satariel's studies in the esoteric area of warp manipulation were shallow. It was only his self-recreating experience that gave him any insight at all. Having rebuilt his consciousness from scattered parts, he was best placed to convey a partial demon consciousness into the systems of the Lionsgate spaceport.
I offer up fealty to the powers that wax and wane, intoned Satariel,
recalling the words imprinted to him via the Iron Warriors from the Word-Bearer's Neverborn Experts. Truly this was an effort of the great new alliance that would shape the future galaxy beneath the rule of Horus.
Of the mortal we take, and of the immortal we give. Threshed to the soul of the warp, I steer the ship of will through the storm of need. Glory to the powers!
The mechadendrite speared out, plunging the sanguinaxial blade into the exposed arm of Fok Saram. Light flared at the contact, like sparks leaping from a broken wire, and travelled along the length of the cable. Blood seeped from the wound, quickly congealing around the entry point like coral accretion on a shipwreck, bubbled and blistered.
I feel the connection.
The voice came from a communications grill, situated above a display screen cracked by bolter impacts. The monitoring station flickered into life, showing a horned face among swirls of static, teeth of lightning flashing in a grin.
I shall obliterate all.
Lionsgate Spaceport, surface approach, 18 hours since assault. It had been 20 years since BIOS, and Forex had not previously thought of that world since its eventual compliance. But there was something about the unreality of this battle that took him back to that campaign. His auto-senses had overloaded within 3 minutes of the main assault beginning, reducing his hearing to that of his own enhanced ears, though muffled by his helm. Roving banks of smoke and gas swathed his view, so that his lenses constantly flickered between different spectrum images, depending on where he looked. One moment bright with infrared radiation, then sliding through the visible light and back again, before switching to dampened night vision and cycling back into ultraviolet. All was cut through by streaks of tracer rounds, continuous muzzle flare, and the afterglow of plasma detonations. He couldn't remove his helm. Even his enhanced physiology would start to succumb to the mixture of toxins billowing among the ash and debris. Toxins his own side had unleashed in the bombardment that now choked the War Master's allies as much as they had devoured the lungs of the Emperor's servants in previous weeks. The warsmiths cared little, driving hundreds of thousands of mortal chattels into the deadly mists and scything cannonade. Like an auto-harvester's spinning blades, battery after battery of anti-personnel and heavier weapons ripped 100-meter-wide swathes through the snarling, wailing morass of troops. Staccato heavy stubber bursts rippled through the slower, deeper beat of macro cannons, whose every shell ripped open craters 50 meters across. Airbursts rained a razor-edged hail of shrapnel, leaving hillocks of rent flesh for following companies to toil across. Forex heaved himself up one such mound, boots sinking into the bloodied meat of a beastman's chest, bolter maglocked to his armour so that he could use both hands to aid his ascent of the Hill of the Dead. Around him were mortal troopers. He had paid little attention when their commander had introduced herself and named their world of origin. Nearly 3,000 of them, armed with crude solid-shot pistols and axes. They seemed inordinately proud of the fact that they had been chosen to deliver him to the Lion's Gate, not understanding that their purpose was as a literal meat shield. 500 had already been cut down by long-range artillery. The others would be lucky to come within sight of the broken armoured portals in the southern slopes of the spaceport, gates that had been painfully wrested open by the preceding 500,000 soldiers. BIOS had been what the Adepts of Terror would later designate a death world, a single brood organism, utterly inimical to other life but for the sole advanced human society that had made their home there, a whole world and populace bent upon destroying those it deemed interlopers, an advanced people and an ecosystem coupled together in shared purpose. Now he faced similar opposition. But there was a single mind directing that enmity, a figure whose intent was written in the strewn bodies and scouring cannonades. The Emperor. And as with BIOS, there would be no surrender, no chance of compromise. Only total extermination would see the Fourth Legion to victory. Cresting the mound of the dead, booted foot snapping the curling horn of a mutant slave, Forex paused for half a second to gaze left and right, before continuing down into the ragged crater on the far side. Ahead of him, about 300 meters away, a rapid series of explosions tore the ground apart, hurling body parts high into the air. How the minefield had not been triggered by previous waves was a mystery. Or perhaps the mines had been deliberately left dormant until now. But as body parts fell in a grisly shower, Forex veered left, the troopers around him turning as well like shoaling fish, angling towards ground chewed over by thousands of earlier footfalls. The drone of jets drew his eye to the heavens, but he could see nothing through the smog of battle. His chronometer told him that the aerial attack had begun, the second front in Kroger's simple plan. As he watched, it started to rain. But on magnification, the rain turned out to be tumbling bodies, tens of thousands of them, falling through the cloud cover, glittering with ice and trailing shards like human comets. He watched the first hit the side of the spaceport about 4 kilometers up, a strange combination of shattering and splattering as frozen heads, limbs and torsos scattered like broken glass, while their warm interiors smeared down the ferrocrete flanks. Bodies descended like hail, smashing into gun batteries and ricocheting from cannon barrels, corpse after corpse, until the flank of the spaceport was carpeted in a compacted mass of flesh and congealed blood. Even Forex was taken aback by the sight of tens of thousands of the Fourth Legion's victims tumbling, splitting, and bouncing off the metal skin of the Lionsgate facility. The Iron Warrior's auxiliary horde was about 0.5 kilometer from the armored barbican that had protected the southern approaches. The structure now a smoking ruin of metal and blasted ferrocrete. Ahead, protected by directional power field generators, siege tanks with dozer blades carved paths through the ruin of masonry and flesh, while pioneer teams with flamers and Fospex missiles cleared the remaining bunkers of the outer ring. Funneled by natural ridges and the projecting walls of the spaceport, the assault wave slowed as it reached the defences. A sea of living creatures pressed closer and closer, while fire raked down from above and mortar shells dropped in constant bombardment. With enemies to the front and sides, and the guns of their masters threatening equal ruin behind them, the vassal regiments poured on, each warrior trusting that some form of providence, or perhaps warp-spawned patronage, would see them survive when millions of others had fallen. If the Iron Warriors had been able to call upon such unquestioning, endless hordes at Bias, the campaign would have lasted weeks, not months. It was the crudest use of raw power, typical of Kroger's thinking. But in the midst of the incalculable carnage, there was a kernel of brilliance. Kroger was not a master strategist, not in the mould of Forex or Perturabo, but he was a brawler, a street fighter that cared nothing for honour or the forms of combat. As Kroger had put it, reflecting perhaps a youth that Forex did not want to know more about, sometimes a shiv was more effective than a broadsword if it was pushed into the right place. He'd continued by explaining some tradition of his people on Olympia, something about eating the grubs found near their city. Most were harmless males, but the females had hidden stings, indistinguishable from the males, except during one mating season. It was a time-honoured assassination method to hide a few females in the meal of an enemy. Via this drawn-out analogy, Kroger had told them of his plan to get 1,000 Iron Warriors into the spaceport, hidden amongst the living debris of the vassal troops. It seemed to be working. Forex was one of only 1,000 Iron Warriors hidden in the tide of the attack, his armour on minimal systems and coated in gore, vox-silent to reduce the chances of detection. Only close manual inspection would pick him out from the churning wave of mortals, and only the indiscriminate barrage that assailed the horde might take him by chance. Lasfire joined the projectiles of the larger weapons as they came within 100 meters of the broken rampart of the barbican. The lower levels of the spaceport yawned beyond, full of smoke, lit by an inferno raging within, as though they stormed the mouth of some ancient hellscape. The ground shuddered with impacts and recoil, causing those around him to lose their footing. He scrambled and crouched and staggered his way forward among them, trying not to reveal himself amidst their struggles. Mouth dry, hearts beating like an Olympian forge hammer, he came into the shadow of the broken gates, towering 40 meters above him. Grenades flashed and the screams of the dying added to the din, but he paid them no heed. Troglodyte mutant ogrins, larger even than a legionary, smashed at side doors with gleaming mauls and hammers, while hundreds of lesser mortals streamed into the firelit innards, only to be scythed down by volleys from platoons of ochre-uniformed defenders. The siegebreaker mutants crashed through their objective, ripping open the emergency access doors adjacent to the courtyard within the barbican. The troopers flowed on, bearing down the lines of defenders with sheer numbers, while Forex and scores of others turned towards the new avenue of attack. A shiv indeed, he thought, pounding down a side corridor into the dark of the spaceport's maintenance labyrinth. Chapter 12. Update from the front. Apostle of Chaos. The Utter Blight. Karachi Flats, 69 days before assault. Stepping out from under the huge train, Zenobi had been expecting it to be nighttime, and so was surprised to discover a strange twilight greeted the disembarking troops. Her immediate surrounds were devoid of illumination, except for the gleam of the train's reactor vents and a few hooded lumens stretched out on cables strung between high poles that led away from the tracks. Others were shuffling slowly forward, eyes cast upwards, and she looked up with them, mouth dropping open at what she saw. The night sky was alight with colour, bursts of red and purple, searing arcs of green and blue. Shooting stars were a constant flicker of movement across the vault of the heavens, beyond which a shifting miasma of glittering dust blotted out the stars.
"Debris," said Member,
and Zenobi knew he was referring to the falling sparks.
"Void war."
She uttered the two words in an awed whisper, scarce believing that she was witnessing such a thing.
"Keep moving!"
Lieutenant Okoye bellowed from behind.
"Others have to get off the platform!"
Still looking up, Zenobi joined the shambling horde of troopers that made their way down the dimly lit track, just one of a crowd of distracted onlookers, moving more by mass consensus than individual volition.
"Look!"
Someone ahead thrust a finger towards the smudge of orange dusk light. A flare of bright white burned across it as a crippled starship plunged into the atmosphere, trailing more sparks as its hull disintegrated. A chorus of gasps greeted the sight, like a crowd watching the celebrations on Unification Day.
"Horus is in orbit."
This came from Sergeant Alexander, betraying his normal stoicism.
"The War Master is nearly here." "If he's winning,"
replied Ketai.
"There's a lot of ships and guns between him and Terra."
"Remember what Jawahir said. We have to assume the War Master's armies will land,"
said Zenobi.
"Not here,"
replied Ketai. He pointed northeast. The sky beyond the horizon was a constant fluctuation of colours, the intensity of the space battle like an artificial aurora.
"Himalaya! The Imperial Palace! It might be over before we get there,"
said someone behind Zenobi. Zenobi's head turned one way and then another, as she tried to see everything, almost falling as her toe caught in a rut on the unpaved path. The near fall brought her mind back to the present and their surroundings.
"Where are we going?"
Other than the faint lumens overhead and the bulk of the train behind them, there was nothing to see. She thought about the platforms, simple raised slabs of rockcrete, seemingly in the middle of nowhere.
"I thought this was Karachi."
"I don't know,"
answered Member, shaking his head. He looked around and shook his head again.
"I don't see anything."
"Did you see what happened to the others? The ones that left the company?"
"Nothing. They were long gone by the time we got off the train."
Zenobi lapsed into agitated silence and followed the huge herd of troopers. Tens of thousands of them were tramping across this featureless wilderness. Perhaps even those at the front didn't know their destination. After a few minutes, the light poles stopped, and the only illumination came from the orbital pyrotechnics that continued to shine down in rainbow sprays of laser and plasma. As the minutes became half an hour, and then an hour, the sense of unease grew. The cold was starting to bite, and the troopers struggled to get heavier coats out of their kit bags, whilst still pressed together and moving. Lieutenant Okoye cut his way through the mass to help them, organizing them into trios that would assist each other in turn, two holding bags and equipment, while the third pulled on their coat. Zenobi had the additional burden of the standard, which she briefly relinquished to the care of Celine and Sergeant Alexander, but retrieved the moment she had buttoned up her coat.
"I thought this was just a transfer banner, Lieutenant,"
said Zenobi.
"We've walked kilometers by now."
"Just keep walking, Trooper," the Lieutenant replied.
but it was clear from his manner that he had no more idea of what was happening than any of them. They walked on, dispersing slightly more as the group spread from the main line of advance. Zenobi heard shouts of dynastic enforcers barked at those they judged to be wandering too far from their invisible course. There was no sign of Captain Egwu, nor the integrity officers, but now and then Zenobi thought she heard the grumble of motor engines, and assumed that some form of transportation had been secured for the upper ranks. She certainly couldn't picture Jawahir trudging through this seemingly endless dust bowl.
Lights!
The call echoed along the column from the companies at the front, but Zenobi couldn't see anything at all, and her inquiries with her taller companions yielded nothing. It was only after a few more minutes' advance that Menba spoke up.
Lights! They look like vehicles. Searchlights?
The column slowed and then stopped, though for those any distance from the front, the reason for the halt was unseen. Slowly, platoon by platoon, they started to shift again, edging forward only a few paces every minute, until finally 1st Company of the 64th could see another railhead a few hundred metres in front. It was far less imposing than the great station where they'd been deposited by the helitransports, just a maze of connecting tracks and dozens of multi-chimneyed locomotives, far smaller than the one that had brought them here, though each still pulled a snake of carriages several hundred metres long. Interspersed between transport compartments were armoured wagons with gun turrets on their roofs and smaller firing ports along their lengths. All was illuminated by the headlights and mounted lumens of a score of half-tracks. When a train was filled, it groaned away beneath plumes of exhaust smoke, each a machine serpent near 300 metres long. Company by company, the troopers from Adaba were funnelled into the waiting transports and shipped east, towards the brightness of the orbital battle. A cabal of company officers waited by the trackside. Zenobi was relieved to see Captain Egwu among them.
"The orbital blockade has collapsed," the company commander announced.
Zenobi heard the collective intake of breath around her, her own gasp lost among the reaction of her companions.
"Forces of the War Master broke into the atmosphere 4 hours ago. Karachi has already been subjected to sporadic orbital bombardment, and so we are avoiding the transfer stations. Landings are expected across Terra, but our destination and purpose remain the same."
An integrity officer, a lean-faced man named Oyunuzi, assigned to Alpha Platoon, held out a handful of paper sheets as Egwu continued.
"Squad leaders will each take one of these and disseminate the information to their squad. They detail specific orders and behavior to minimize detection by orbital scan and aircraft overflight. There are far larger and more important targets than half a dozen trains crossing the Arabadlands. Even so, we have several days' travel ahead of us, and the less attention we draw, the better."
She stopped as a junior officer appeared out of the gloom, the coils and box of a long-range Vox hanging from a shoulder harness. Zenobi wasn't close enough to hear what was said, but the urgency in the young man's expression and the reaction from the captain were enough to communicate that the news was not welcome. Zenobi's throat tightened sympathetically as Egwu started a hectic, hushed consultation with the integrity officer and the handful of nearby lieutenants. Those behind were unconsciously but inexorably pushing forward to see or hear, creating a building pressure wave against those nearer the front. Someone stepped on Zenobi's heel as they shifted position, one hand steadying on her shoulder. There were snarled complaints ringing around her, and she saw elbows and even fists being flung around as the troopers started pushing into one another.
"We have to get moving!"
Ketai shouted, waving his hand at one of the enforcers lining the side of the train. A group of troopers from the platoon, Zenobi included, shuffled forward several steps, trying to allow more space. But this vacuum simply drew in those behind, causing a ripple to flow back through the growing crowd of waiting soldiers. Then the lights went out. The sudden darkness sucked at Zenobi, leeching the last of her nerve from her body. A squeak of a cry escaped her lips before she clamped down on the fear. Mixed shouts of panic and anger broke the stillness of the night. Zenobi took another step, twisting her ankle on a buried rock. She threw out a hand and grabbed an arm to stop herself falling, heart hammering as she imagined the company surging forward, trampling over her in the moments of her fall. "Steady!" It was Sergeant Alexander that grabbed her coat, keeping her upright. He turned, teeth bared as he berated the troopers directly behind them. Her eyes were getting accustomed to the dim illuminations of the orbital battle, the outline of the train and people resolving into focus in front of her. A small lantern appeared from the left, illuminating the enforcer that carried it. The knot of officers broke apart, the lieutenants hurrying into the twilight.
"Everybody onto the train now!"
barked Okoye, slapping a hand on member's shoulder, almost shoving the trooper towards the locomotive.
"By squads and platoon! No, no, no!"
It was the worst possible decision. Like water through a broken dam, the Defence Corps soldiers burst forward, spooked by the darkness and then panicked by the sudden command. Gripping the banner pole tight, her lasgun and kit bag slapping against her side, Zenobi started forward, got caught with her neighbour and fell. Hands grabbed her shoulders, wrenching her up, and she was propelled towards the nearest train door, a set of metal steps folded down for access. She regained her feet before she had to be bodily thrown aboard, wrestling her burden sideways through the door, even as Ketai pushed in beside her. By the same miracle by which he always seemed to be ahead of his squad, Sergeant Alexander was in the companionway just inside the door, marshalling the new arrivals.
"Across to the other side! All the way to the far end! Across to the other side! All the way to the far end!"
The troopers piled on, into the darkness of the compartment. It was about 30 meters long, 6 wide, and the only lights glimmered through a row of small windows that ran the length of the join between the wall and roof. There were hammock nets bundled to the ceiling, and the benches that ran crosswise along the carriage had cloth pockets for those seated behind to stow small possessions. The carriage was split along its length by a thin latticework, through which Zenobi could see others herding onto the train. Curses followed the troopers as they negotiated their way around wooden benches with footlockers beneath, navigating by bruised shins and clattered knees until they found space. With the soldiers came the froth of muttered speculation.
"Enemy on their way, I heard. Something spotted us."
"Gotta be a ship in orbit."
"Airstrike," she said.
"Definitely airstrike.
I heard the captain say we had to get moving in 5 minutes. There's no way we'll all be aboard by then,"
said Member in reply to this last claim. Zenobi climbed onto a bench to look out the window, and saw figures flowing between the wagons, heading to other trains on parallel sidings. A grumble announced the motors starting, and with a jolt, a few seconds later, the train began to move, almost spilling Zenobi from the bench.
"No, stop!"
she shouted, as though the driver would hear her, 200 meters further up the track.
"There's people cutting past!"
She pressed her face back against the window so she could peer through the reflections into the darkness, others around her ascending the benches to look as well. The train was moving at a crawl, and still some of the troopers were daring to dart between the carriages. She couldn't see but heard screams, as some of them weren't quick enough, disappearing beneath the grinding metal of the wheels. Turning around, she looked over the packed troops to see the doors were still open. Alexander and some others were there, hauling latecomers through the opening as they ran up alongside the moving vehicle. A little closer, amidst the mass, were the uniforms of the officers, Egwu among them. People were coming on board from both sides now, but the rate of their boarding had slowed to a person every few seconds, not the constant rush that had greeted the original command. The train was picking up speed, moving from a walk to a jog, enough that those that had been chasing it started to fall behind, legs unaccustomed to running, giving way to tiredness after a few hundred meters. The track was curving to the left. Through the window, Zenobi could see groups of abandoned troopers silhouetted against the glimmer of lights on the horizon. Brighter flares flashed across the night. A chorus of distant cracks cut across the clanking of the train.
"Bolters!"
someone yelled. More small flares of red crisscrossed the gloom, converging in the patches of darker shadow that were the troopers left behind. A sudden stark flash of muzzle fire lit the distance, and a rapid-fire thunder drifted after the departing trains. A few seconds later, an explosion lit the middle distance, briefly highlighting ramshackle buildings that lined the track, a makeshift way station that the night had hidden. Zenobi flinched from the brightness, the sudden light searing her vision. But in the instant before momentary blindness, she thought she had seen armoured figures against the billow of flames. She stepped down from the bench and dragged her kit bag and lasgun to her lap, flopping back onto the seat in stunned silence.
"Did you see them?"
whispered Menba, bending over the back of the bench from behind. Zenobi stared ahead, not really looking at anything, her vision fogged by shock.
"I'm not sure what they saw."
She raised a shaking hand to wipe her brow. Her coat was now hot in the throng of troopers, and her short curls of hair matted with sweat from the brief but sudden exertions that had got her to the train. Her gut was spinning, and her pulse was unfeasibly loud in her ears, drumming incessantly like a forge hammer. Everything else was muted, 100 conversations taking place in a neighbouring room. In that moment, she knew that the war was real. It wasn't some distant battle beyond the stars. It wasn't even a future conflict at the end of a train line, to be fought around the walls of the Imperial Palace. Folk of Adabar were dead now, slain by the violence of the struggle between the Emperor and Horus. Thousands had probably died on the production lines, worked beyond their limit, injured by machines that should have been maintained better, their bodies aged by the greater toil of the war effort. But that was different. That was at home, where they would be remembered, their bodies taken to the end fires. What would happen to those they had left in the Arab Badlands? Did she know any of them? Would they be missed? It was suddenly so large and impersonal. Would anyone remember her? Drops of water fell on her hands, and for several seconds she was confused, unable to recognize her own tears. Katabatic Plains, 18 hours since assault. Descending the gunship's ramp, Abaddon paused for a second before stepping onto the bloodied dirt of Terra. He halted a few metres on and looked around, for the first time seeing the siege from below rather than above. Behind him came a bodyguard of Sons of Horus, but a raised hand stopped them as they disembarked.
"Await me here,"
he told them, turning to the broken remnants of a defence keep that Layak had chosen to be the site of his ritual. The ground about it was littered with the corpses of Imperial Army troopers, skin blotched, tongues lolling, slain by some deadly disease or poison. Passing into the ruin, Abaddon came upon Layak in a central hall. In the hours before departing the vengeful spirit, he had been absent from Abaddon's presence, unusually so, and the Sons of Horus commander had found the experience partly a relief and partly filled with suspicion. On the premise that one should keep one's enemies close, he was sure that he shouldn't let Layak out of his sight, for all that the Word-Bearer enjoyed almost unparalleled support from the Warmaster. Now he found himself in close proximity to the Crimson Apostle, and was of the firm opinion that absence was always preferable. The sorcerer had selected one of the overrun defence positions, a bastion of the outer defences directly north of the Lionsgate spaceport. Through the broken roof, Abaddon could see the spear of the port reaching into the storm clouds. Evidently, the bastion had changed hands several times, and nobody had bothered with the expense of energy required to remove the dead. Halls and corridors were choked with casualties from both sides, mostly human, but a few abhumans, mutants. There were two power-armoured bodies in the livery of Mortarion's Legion. The bastion was located close to the central axis of the Death Guard's first assault, more than 1,000 kilometres from the Lion's Gate.
"Why here?"
growled Abaddon.
"How will this get Perturabo into the spaceport?"
Layak gestured to the ground. Carrion eaters crawled across the bodies, giant millipedes, mutant rats, and black-backed beetles, impervious to the toxic fumes that lay like an ankle-deep cloud across much of the katabatic plains. Fungal growths wavered with strange life, puffing clouds of spores into the polluted air.
"The God of Decay has already passed his eye across this place and found it pleasing. The barrier to the Neverborn comes not from the Lionsgate port, but the Emperor. It is from within the heart of the palace that we shall erode the shield."
Typhon of the Death Guard was there also, crouched next to a distended corpse, allowing a segmented arthropod to crawl around his hand like some obscene pet. Since Abaddon had last met him, Callus Typhon was as much changed as his gene father. Abaddon recalled that Mortarion had named him Typhus, as though the morphing of his body necessitated a new identity. Though he still wore his heavy Terminator plate, as did Abaddon, it was pitted with odd corrosion, the ceramite covered in lesions like diseased bone. Organic-looking funnels splayed from the carapace across the power plant upon his back, a fume of buzzing insects constantly leaking forth. A horn protruded from the brow of Typhus's helm, reminiscent of the emissaries of the god of decay that Abaddon sometimes witnessed in the War Master's warp chamber. The Death Guard bore a long scythe, a smaller replica of Mortarion's signature weapon. Its pitted blade shone with an earthly light, a pale gleam in the death fog. Perturabo arrived soon after, his sour demeanour filling the bastion as much as his bulk. His presence was more oppressive than Horus's, his glare a challenge to any that dare meet it as it swept across the chamber at the heart of the bastion.
"Your mechanical companions must wait outside," said Laoc,
gesturing towards the iron circle advancing through the door behind the Primarch.
"Send away my guards, so that I remain alone amongst some of the Legion's most powerful warriors."
Perturabo turned his head towards the Blade Slaves, who stood a little back from Laoc.
"We all know how deceit is the handmaid of sorcery. I have not forgotten how Fulgrim earned his transformation at my expense."
Laoc's Blade Slaves turned as one and departed by an archway. The Crimson Apostle kept his inhuman gaze upon the Primarch, his voice tempered by patience.
"Your presence is not necessary, Lord of Iron. If you wish to leave, you were invited so that you might observe as you requested. Their soulless minds disturb the etheric qualities of the ritual."
With his own command reflected back at him, Perturabo had little choice but to comply, and the iron circle withdrew, clanking into an antechamber. When they were gone, Laoc stepped into the centre of the room. His gaze moved from one to the next, then stopped, his words intended for the Primarch.
"Were you to question Magnus or one of his thousand sons about the nature of the warp, you would come to a very different understanding to what I will demonstrate to you. The mystics of Prospero analyze the warp as analogy, thinking they might discern patterns and laws and equations from its movements. While it has moods and phases and textures, the warp is a law unto itself, and so that is how Magnus's hubris led him into folly. You must abandon any sense that there is a science to be learnt, and instead focus on the concept of ritual and faith."
Perturabo grunted, listening intently to every word. Abaddon was not sure whether it was wise to impart too much detail to the Lord of Iron. Perturabo excelled at perfecting what others started, and creating marvel from nothing. Armed with deeper knowledge of the powers, there might be no limit to what his imagination and craft could conjure.
"Think of our place within the warp as a relationship, emotional rather than physical. Just as you and I have a context with each other that is separate from our bodies, our past, our attitudes to one another, our shared experiences. These cannot be catalogued. They defy calculation. They might even be misremembered or imagined. Yet to the warp, all of that is real, while the physical is unreal."
"I'm not sure I fully grasp your meaning, but continue," said the Primarch.
"The ritual we used to allow your brothers to land upon Terra had a physical component and a spiritual one. Slaughter played its part."
Laoc waved a hand to the corpses that surrounded them.
"Slaughter is meaningless without emotion. If I chopped down a forest of trees, I would end as much life, but nobody would call it slaughter, and I could not use it to summon the smallest manifestation of the powers. Death is intangible, as is fear, hatred, anger. These are the energies of the warp, the sustenance of the gods. The physical creates the spiritual. When the two are molded and directed appropriately, A bond is made, and passage between the realms can occur.
I see your meaning more clearly, said Perturabo. And how is the bond connected?
That is the art, not the science, Perdliak. It is the belief that shapes all things, and the dedication in heart to the powers. Words, symbols, and actions are still physical properties of the ritual to help shape the faith that stems from within. I have studied these mysteries for years to smooth the passage, but it is my faith that creates the bond between me and the gods. For their boons, you must give yourselves over to them.
Abaddon saw Perturabo's eyes narrow.
Like my brothers.
That is but one way. They have taken to themselves a patron and have become shaped by their inner desires. The gods are collectively happy to receive your worship.
Worship. Gods. Perturabo clearly struggled with the concepts, though whether intellectually or dogmatically it was impossible to know.
You once followed a god, though he would not let you call him such.
Laek glanced now at Abaddon.
Why not serve powers that grant favour in return, rather than spurn your love and dedication?
We are here for a more specific purpose, grunted Abaddon, uncomfortable beneath the gaze of the Crimson Apostle. To break the barrier that protects the spaceport. Laek crouched, dipping his fingers towards the exposed viscera of a body at his feet. Bugs scuttled away, clustering around the feet of Typhus like chicks seeking protection from their hen. The word-bearer's sorcerer stood, pulling out a rope of intestine. It was clearly diseased, marked by pale blisters and dark scabs.
The gods will feast upon the light of the Emperor, and in doing so will extinguish it. We must empower them with our prayers and sacrifices, lending them strength with our faith, giving of ourselves unto them, that they may provide for us. In our commitment we grant them energy. We come upon this world in an auspicious time, when the warp waxes strong and the physical power of the Emperor wanes. The same thinning of the veil between realms that allowed our ships to penetrate the star system also brings close the breath of the gods.
Talk of extinguishing the Emperor's light, and what the Chaos Gods intended for humanity, sat uneasily with Abaddon, but he said nothing. Perturabo was ill at ease for a different reason.
You speak in metaphor, clouding the truth with esoteric nonsense.
The Primarch flexed his fingers in agitation.
Do not hide your knowledge with these riddles. Speak in plain terms.
I return to my initial point, said Laek,
looking at the organ in his hand.
The physical and the immaterial. The telethesic ward is generated by the Emperor himself. He is the physical. There is none except perhaps Magnus that could break it in direct opposition, and it would slay your brother in the doing. The only way to remove the barrier is to pile upon such pressure of the immaterial that its creator cannot sustain it. And as you would know, Master of Sieges, the greatest way to seize a wall is from inside as well as out.
We need to be inside the ward, Perturabo snarled. But it is to gain entry to the port that we need to bring down the barrier.
Not so, Lord of Iron, said Abaddon. Perhaps we need the presence of your brothers for the victory. But a breach can be made beforehand.
Your plan surely does not rely on having Angron leading the charge all the way to the bridges.
No.
Perturabo glared daggers at the first captain.
I can break open the gates by conventional means.
That is good, said Laek. We can begin the binding of the immaterial before we need to create the physical. Something to start the process, you could say. Do you remember Samus?
The demon that almost destroyed the phalanx, said Perturabo.
That was a masterful plan, though Dawn thwarted it eventually.
We were able to insert Samus into such a vulnerable position by implanting a connection into the form of Mercedi Oliton, who was already bound to the entity by shared experience. In order to breach barriers of the nature we face here, to create a gateway across the telethesic ward, one can use a physical vessel to mask the Neverborn presence, or anchor it. No pure demon can set foot on Terra yet. But our demon Primarch allies can do so because of their once physical nature. Though made of the immaterium now, they yet leave an imprint on the real universe that gives their presence solidity. Similarly, my possessed brethren and certain Neverborn-powered artifacts have been brought to the surface because of their physicality.
And what will you use?
Typha stepped closer, a fume of tiny flies issuing from the grill of his helm as he spoke.
Why am I here?
You have become the host of the Destroyer Hive, and that gives you considerable power, said Laak. Your voice echoes far in the warp, and there is one you must help me call.
What will you summon?
Samus is of an order of Neverborn, the word-bearers call the Heralds of the Ruinstorm. There is one for each of the powers, strong in the favour of their patrons. Your grandfather, the Lord of Decay, can send to us a creature that is named Korbak's Utterblight.
I thought you said no demon can be summoned to the surface of Terra, said Abaddon.
And we stand outside the ward, added Perturabo. What use is a creature barred entry, as much as my distorted brothers? No demon can manifest, Laak said sharply. Samus was a Neverborn of the soul, working through the minds of those it sought. All of the Heralds of the Ruinstorm are such, their greatest power being the corruption of thought, not body. The Utterblight does not need to take form to begin its work. The life within death, the breath on your lips, it is the spirit of hope, seeded in the hearts of all humans.
As he spoke, the intestine started to move in his grasp, a slow pulse rippling along its length. The pulsing grew more vigorous, becoming writhing, and then curving up out of the corpse like a viscerous serpent. With a wet tear, the organ pulled from the body, its ragged end growing maw-like, rows of fangs erupting from the pallid flesh.
Behold the cosmic worm, the Kruak maggot that feeds upon the universe, declared Laak.
He held out the coiling mass towards Typhus, who held out an arm for it to crawl onto, looping about the wrist and forearm.
A marvel, said the Death Guard, turning his hand one way and the other to examine the entity. A tendril from the worms that burrow through Nurgle's garden itself.
Indeed. That chew their way through all of existence. The worms of entropy.
Laak crouched and punched his fist through the chest of another corpse. He prized open the shattered breastbone, and then reached in to pluck free the heart within. It seemed a shriveled, small thing in his palm.
The source of life, the seat of love, the vault of hope and courage and defiance.
The word-bearer held up the heart and began to chant in a strange tongue, witch-lights playing around his hand. Abaddon felt something tugging at him, an insubstantial grip that teased at his own hearts, seeming to pluck at the arteries in his chest. He tried to catch a breath but found himself unable, as though he were drowning. His gaze flicked to Perturabo, who watched the proceedings intensely, his eyes moving from one component of the ritual to the next, never stopping long on Laak or Typhus or their grisly accoutrement. Laak's chanting grew louder, and the warp glow intensified, the heart in his grip like a weak yellow lumen. Abaddon's hearts had almost stopped, so slow was their beat, but he could not take the breath to utter an injunction, and his body seemed paralyzed. He stared at the heart in the sorcerer's hand and saw it beat in time to the thud in his chest. Only his human heart functioned. His secondary organ was like a useless weight behind his chest bone. His heart pulsed again, and the thing in Laak's fingers twitched in sympathy. The sorcerer turned to him then, proffering the heart like a prize. Abaddon raised his hand to take it, almost drawing his fingers back as the heart pumped once more in time to his own, gaining rhythm and speed. Laak's six eyes bored into him, yellow will-o'-the-wisps in the fog and flies, moving in and out of focus as oxygen starvation started to affect Abaddon's vision. As the offering plopped down into his palm, Abaddon felt a moment of release and took in a long, shuddering breath. Now he felt a triple pulse of his own hearts and the organ in his hand, thudding in unison with each other. From Typhus, the gut snake lifted up as though scenting prey, its toothy mouth gaping, sweeping left and right in an eyeless search. Abaddon took a step closer, holding out the beating, glowing heart.
The intestinal serpent stood out straight from Typhus's arm, like a rearing cobra, a gurgle issuing from its rippling throat. It descended with purpose, not striking swiftly, but almost delicately plucking the heart from the palm of Abaddon's gauntlet. Leaving a rope of thick drool, it pulled back, the passage of the heart into its innards visible by the bulge that travelled its length. Leak's chanting resumed, becoming more strident, almost a screeching. The gut serpent started to weave back and forth, and leapt from Typhus to judder across the floor, spasming as if in pain. It coiled about itself, teeth sinking into its own flesh, where the glow of the heart shone through. Razor-sharp teeth opened up its meat with ease, and it swallowed the heart again, chewing it from its own insides. It started to swell as it ate, spines and scales breaking from the surface, rows of paired wings splitting in the manner of a moth emerging from its cocoon. Lifting from the ground with a buzz of dozens of wings, the scaled serpentine creature weaved around the legs of Leak, moving in time to the tempo of his voice. It moved to his icon staff, and then around his head, forming an obscene halo. Then it ascended, flitting across the chamber, coiling and uncoiling as though at play, growing larger still until its girth was as wide as Abaddon's waist. With a shriek that was echoed from the mask of Leak, it plunged down, spearing into the corpse pile in front of the sorcerer. Like a lasdrill, it burrowed swiftly into the charnel heap. It was several meters long, far greater than the depth of the bodies, but continued downwards, disappearing into the ground. As its tail vanished into the exposed viscera, Abaddon caught a momentary sight of a flowering bloom made of gristle and veins, a swirling hole at its centre, before the disgusting petals closed and the wound erupted into a pile of festering meat laced with hundreds of maggots. With a gasp, Leak stumbled backwards, eyes dimming. Abaddon made no move to assist him, but watched as the word-bearer straightened, leaning a little on his staff for support.
"Beautiful," whispered Typhus.
"It is done," croaked Leak.
He turned three pairs of eyes upon Perturabo.
"The Atterblight will begin its burrowing into the souls of the defenders. Now it is time for you to launch your attack."
The Primarch surveyed the chamber, examining Leak and Typhus, the corpses where the worm demon had disappeared. He nodded, once, and then left without a word. The clank of the iron circle joining him reverberated through the bastion.
"Now we return to Horus," said Abaddon.
"No, not yet," replied Leak. "The ritual must be completed within the ward, when the utter blight has thinned the barrier sufficiently. Typhus, return to your Primarch and continue your assaults. Know that every disease-ridden corpse feeds the Kruak worm and makes it stronger."
"We shall make a banquet for the utter blight,"
promised the plague sorcerer, lifting his scythe in salute. Abaddon watched him go and then approached Leak. He stopped, two paces short of weapons reach, aware of the blade slaves that had silently re-entered the chamber behind the word-bearer.
"What did you do to me, sorcerer?"
he growled, holding back the urge to seize Leak and pound the answer from him.
"I gave you a taste of what will come. The slightest inkling of what your gene-father has endured to gain his power. When you come before the gods and demand their support, you must give of yourself for their favour."
"And am I? The ritual, it bound me to that creature somehow?"
"No. You are free from any bargain or influence. It is to Typhus's fate that the star maggot is drawn, not yours. This will not be the last time Typhus seeks out the worm of entropy for his designs."
"You speak of matters beyond the end of the siege."
"Horus's victory, or defeat, is not the end. It is the beginning."
Leak turned away, took a step and looked back at Abaddon.
"In time, you will embrace that destiny."
Abaddon watched the word-bearer depart, his mood sour. He thought about the War Master and his brothers, the changes wrought upon Typhus and his companions, and of the Neverborn and Possessed that he had seen in Horus's court, Tormageddon and others. He could see clearly what price the powers demanded, beyond simple allegiance. Laiac seemed convinced that Abaddon would one day voluntarily pay it. What was he willing to give to serve his father and brothers? Chapter 13. The Ghost. Dangerous Beliefs. Short Supplies. Palatine Ark, Quarantine Zone, Barrack C, 2 days since assault. Several different nightmares had tormented Katsuhiro since he had arrived at the defense line. Coming within the walls, he had hoped perhaps his nighttime tortures would end. Like all hopes he had nurtured since arriving, that was another to be crushed by reality. He murmured in his bunk, trapped in a vision in which his skin and flesh fell away piece by piece. He felt no pain, but was left a bare skeleton, green and grey moss growing from his bones as he lay in a shallow grave. The moss thickened into fresh muscle, giving him a new form, and flowers blossomed on his verdant, not corpse. All the while he heard singing, wordless, but the notes like a waterfall, sometimes light and refreshing, other times booming and powerful. It was not the dream that was the nightmare, but the waking. This night he was ripped from the embrace of the plant death by Chastain, barging into the dorm he shared with 50 other guards. All of them were veterans from outside. Nobody ever called it the first line or the outer defences anymore. The outside was all they had to say. I was on the outside, were you? Even through the farts and snores, every man and woman woke at the loud footfalls of the new arrival, their senses keyed to any potential danger, a paranoia that even kilometres of high walls and gun towers would never set at ease for the rest of their lives.
"What's the racket?"
demanded Sergeant Ongoko.
"Something's in the mess hall,"
Chastain told them.
"Get your guns!" "Where's the officer of the watch?"
Ongoko asked, as Katsuhiro and the others rolled from their bunks. Katsuhiro dodged aside as Corporal Lennox, in the bunk above him, dropped straight to the floor.
"Quick! Forget your shirts!"
Chastain hovered at the doors, ashen-faced and wide-eyed, and then disappeared back into the corridor. Bare feet padding on the varnished ferrocrete floor of the barracks, East Wall's second guard company followed, snatching lasguns from the wall racks as they flowed towards the passageway. Katsuhiro was about 5 from the front of the line, Lennox beside him.
"Why didn't they sound the alarm?"
asked Katsuhiro. Lennox just shrugged in reply. It was only 50 meters to the mess, probably the reason Chastain had headed to the dorm rather than the watch station on the floor above. Lasgun in hand, Katsuhiro followed the others through the double doors into a broad hall, filled with tables and benches, enough for 500 troopers to be seated at one time. The only light was from dull orange night lumens set in the walls, barely enough to see the vague shapes of the furniture. The serving hatches in the far wall were all closed with plasteel shutters, but a paler light shone through the gaps from the kitchens beyond, swaying and dipping as though the source were moving back and forth.
"First and third squad with me!"
called Ongoko, not bothering to wait to see if any officers were going to turn up. He pointed to the doors to the right of the shutters.
"Second and fourth! That way! 5th, hold the rear!"
Part of second squad, Katsuhiro hurried towards the right-hand doors. The light played out through the cracks between and below, ripples of white tinged with green. His hairs prickled across his arms and the back of his neck as he caught a strange scent. It brought to mind a forest canopy and mouldering leaves beneath, though he had never seen such a thing. While Lennox reached for the door, Katsuhiro had a flash of the dream, the earthy scent of mulch, soft beneath his rebirthing form.
"Weapons ready!"
croaked the corporal, voice breaking as trembling fingers curled around the door handle. Katsuhiro brought up his lasgun, Spilk and Calamar to either side of him with weapons ready too. Lennox dragged open the door and the trio stepped forward, Spilk turning to the left, Calamar to the right, while Katsuhiro was focused ahead. The light came from everywhere, flashing from the reflective surfaces of the massive ovens and stovetops, dancing around the dormant lumen fittings, gleaming from rows of pans hanging on wall hooks. The thud of the opening doors at the far end drew their attention, guns swinging towards Sergeant Ongoko and his squad. Katsuhiro advanced, allowing the rest of second squad into the kitchen, gun barrels swinging towards the shadows cast by the erratic light. The tiles were cold underfoot, a sensation helping to keep him grounded amid the otherworldly shimmer. The smell of nature grew stronger, and Katsuhiro thought he heard the sound of wind in trees, the rustle of leaves and creak of arboreal giants.
There!
Kalama jabbed her lasgun towards a patch of wall between the chimneys of two bread ovens. Light rippled over bare brick, seeping along the lines of mortar. Dust crumbled where it touched, each speck falling slowly, glinting like a tiny particle of light. Blinking, Katsuhiro thought he saw an outline in the gathering motes. Instantly he thought of a man, beautiful and strong. An arm reached out towards the troopers. He heard Spilk snarl in disgust, and the hum of an energy cell charging.
No!
Katsuhiro knocked his companion's lasgun upwards as he pulled the trigger, the beam of red light blasting into the ceiling. Panicked shouts came from others, and a flurry of shots erupted along the kitchen from both ends, hiding the wall in a cloud of exploding brick dust. For a heartbeat longer, Katsuhiro saw a face amidst the billowing specks, frown creased in disappointment, full lips pursed. Then it was gone.
By the forefathers, that was disgusting, muttered Kalama.
Katsuhiro turned to see her lip ripple in disgust, eyes fixed on where the apparition had appeared. He was confused. The entity he had seen in the ghost light had been anything but disgusting. The memory of it left an ache in his chest, longing for its return.
Everyone stay where you are,
barked Sergeant Ongoku.
Nobody's going nowhere until this is reported.
Katsuhiro caught a last flurry of leaf whisper and the forest scent.
What are you happy about?
Demanded Lennox, eyes narrowed.
Nothing, Corporal,
Katsuhiro said quickly, pushing the smile from his lips. Karachi Flats, 68 days before assault. A strange light brought Zenobi from a fitful slumber. She awoke huddled on a bench, the company banner clutched to her like a child, her pack and lasgun sticking out of a half-open locker underneath. Her head rested on Celine's shoulder, a folded coat for a pillow, who in turn was butted against Member, who sat wedged against the wall. The light came through the windows in a wavering golden haze. It was sunlight, itself a rarity to the downhivers, but unlike anything Zenobi had seen before. She had managed the occasional trip to the hive skin to watch a sunrise. It was virtually a rite of passage for those working on the line, and recognized that there was something sickly about the light that crept into the carriage to cast thin, long shadows. There were far more people inside the compartment than intended, so that the benches were filled with half-asleep troopers, nearly as many curled on the floor between. She rose quietly, mumbles and groans sounding from those around her as their weight shifted, though she tried to ease herself free without disturbing them. She almost tripped over her kit bag, and took a couple of seconds to shift it around and force it fully into the wooden locker.
"What are you doing?"
murmured Achebe, slumping sideways into the space created by her departure. His eyelids fluttered open, a yawn splitting his face to reveal a dark tongue and stained teeth.
"Is it breakfast?"
Others were stirring, or had already awoken, either just sitting quietly where they had found themselves, or, like Zenobi, picking their way carefully through the maze of bodies to see what was going on. She saw nothing of the officers, integrity or regular, and assumed that they had found alternative accommodation more suited to their rank. Sergeants Alexander and Asari Dokubo were crouched in the vestibule by the doors, sharing a knife to pare away slices of something from a rations packet. Alexander looked up as her movement caught his attention. His eyes were bloodshot, dark rims around them, but his expression was as determined as ever.
"I need some fresh air,"
Zenobi said the words, and a moment later realized how ridiculous the request must sound, coming from a downhiver who had lived in a family hab chamber only a little less crowded than the train car.
"I feel..."
Alexander handed the knife to the other sergeant and stood up, hand moving to the handle of a door behind him.
"There's a sort of gantry on the roof."
He opened the door, and the noise of the train's passage intensified.
"There's a few folks up there already."
She thanked him with a nod and stepped past. A gnarled hand barred her, the fingers moving to the haft of the banner that Zenobi had brought with her.
"Don't want that going over this side, do we?"
Alexander said sternly. Zenobi reconsidered going outside, but her head was spinning, and she really did need to get away from the smell and the heat of everybody. Reluctantly, she relinquished her grip on the banner and watched Alexander stow it in the corner. Through the door was a short walkway that connected to the next carriage, made of wooden slats and canvas. Guide ropes lined the sides at waist and shoulder height, but it didn't look at all inviting as it swung with the motion of the locomotive. Thankfully, the ladder to the carriage roof was a set of metal rungs bolted to the end of the car itself. Zenobi pulled herself up, taking deep breaths as she did so. The air was cool, not cold, tainted by the oil fume of the engine that passed along from the smokestacks, but it didn't taste of sweat and fear, so that it made it the most refreshing draught she had ever taken. Another smell lingered on the breeze, mozo. It reminded her of her aunts and uncles. Her mother and father were both against smoking, a rarity among their family, and her thoughts strayed thousands of kilometers back across the world to Adaba. There were three others on the gantry, which was little more than a meter-wide strip of metal with a short lip that ran the full length of the roof. There was nothing to stop anyone falling off, but the train wasn't going fast, so if the fall didn't cause a serious injury, it wouldn't be too much trouble to run and jump back on. She didn't recognize the three that were there, two men and a woman. Their eyes flicked to her chest and hers to theirs, checking out their identity badges.
Epsilon. Command squad,
said the woman, raising an eyebrow and affecting an air of being impressed. Her eyes were lined with wrinkles, a touch of grey at her temples. Her hands had calluses from manual work, a few burn scars on her cheeks that spoke of labour near the forges. If she'd been an uphiver, she might well have been 40 or 50, but life aged one fast on the line, and Zenobi guessed the other woman was 10 years older than her, perhaps 15 at the most.
Zenobi,
she introduced herself, choosing to drop her second name for the time being.
You're all from Beta Platoon?
Better Beta than nothing,
one of the men joked, flashing a gap-toothed grin. He extended a hand.
Name's Wrench. Well, not my name, obviously, but what folks call me.
Wrench. You good at fixing things, I guess.
He nodded and drew a slender hand-rolled paper tube from inside his coat and offered it. Zenobi shook her head with a polite smile and pulled herself up the last couple of rungs. They all shuffled as best they could to allow her to step by, venturing further along the top of the carriage. Zenobi picked her way carefully past. She'd ridden moving crane booms when she had been no older than 10, but the manufactories were definitely lacking in crosswind, unlike the roof of the train. She looked back along the length of the vehicle, saw the track beyond it stretching into nothing. The ground was hillier here than where they'd embarked, a line of low mountains visible along the horizon to the right. There was a smudge against the sky, perhaps smoke where they'd transferred. It was dwarfed by vast columns of black fumes billowing into the sky from beyond the horizon. Every now and then she thought she saw a flash or heard the distant thunder of a detonation. It could have been a trick of sunlight and the rattling of the car. Turning around, she looked where they were heading. An indistinct haze in the furthest distance. Might have been more mountains, but it was impossible to tell. The sky above them danced with constant colour, reds and oranges of fire mostly, sometimes struck through with flares of blue and purple, or a stark beam of yellow plinking down from orbit. She watched for several minutes, thinking the display would stop. It didn't. She swallowed hard, confronted by the impossibility of imagining the power that was being unleashed upon the Imperial Palace. It stretched reality to consider the forces raging through the atmosphere and the titanic energy holding it at bay. How long could such defences last against such unruly might? Zenobi turned quickly as she felt someone standing behind her. It was the third of the Beta Platoon members, the one that had not introduced himself. The other two were deep in quiet conversation, arguing over something Wrench was holding, a book or pamphlet of some kind.
When we find ourselves powerless, we understand what it is to look for the power beyond our knowing, said the man.
He smiled warmly, then thrust his hands into the pockets of his coveralls, swaying gently with the motion of the train. He had the easy balance of one that had lived as an oar rigger, riding the monorail cars from the foundry to the production line.
I know where this power comes from,
Zenobi replied, eyes turning heavenwards.
The wrath of Horus visited upon the city of the Emperor.
And he resists, doesn't he?
The man took in a deep breath, nostrils flaring.
I'm Nato. Zenobi, right?
She nodded confirmation.
What if I told you that this wasn't about the War Master, but something vaster and more majestic?
I'd say you have a knack for stories,
Zenobi replied cautiously.
Or perhaps fancy yourself a line philosopher?
We all wonder about life, don't we? What it's about. Why do we do what we do? Who makes us what we are?
He stepped closer, so Zenobi moved aside. Nato sauntered past, still talking, not looking at her.
Most of the time it doesn't amount to a bucket of bolts. Am I right?
Zenobi said nothing, not sure what he was talking about. This didn't deter him.
We're standing on top of a recommissioned mining train. That's what this is, I've seen them. Heading towards the most destructive force ever to visit Terra. Wouldn't you like to know what that's really about? Why this war had to happen?
It's about Terra, replied Zenobia. We all know it. Control Terra, you can control the Imperium. Slavery on one side, freedom on the other. For Adaba, for Terra, and for all of humanity.
The recruiter's words so well-crafted, aren't they?
Are they false?
Nato turned, still casual, a half-smile on his lips.
I'm not trying to trick you, Zeno.